Hello and welcome to this week's dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up there in Preston. Unity FM on 93.5 FM in the Midlands. And Radio Verulam in St Albans.
Coming up on the show today, we have Michaela Dennis in conversation with the poet Tim Burrows about his latest CD, Soundscapes, and he's reading his poetry with his own musical backings.
Our guest this week is Jack Phillips of the Free Bus Project, and we also have Claudia Giulietta Duque in the third and final part of our look at mafia government attacks on Colombian journalists.
There's poetry from Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and Jeff Sparks presents his usual What's On Guide and Song of the Week. Our guest in the studio today is Jack Phillips, one of the founder members of the Bristol charity Free Bus. Free Bus is a non-profit organisation funded by memberships and donations from the people of Bristol. The first regular Free Bus service is due to be launched on Saturday, June the 11th, 2011, need I say. Jack, hello.
Hi.
So how did it all start out? When did you first think about doing Free Bus?
Free Bus was launched originally in July of last year, and we had an open public meeting which was attended by about 50 people, including some representatives from local bus operators. And it got a really good response immediately, and within 2 weeks we'd had £1,000 pledged to the project.
Right.
And so we decided there must be some enthusiasm for such an organisation, and so things have taken off from there, really.
Okay, so how wide an area are you talking about when you're talking about a free bus service?
Well, the initial service is quite a short loop, which basically connects Bristol Temple Meads with the city centre. I mean, I think one of the things that we all think about Bristol is that, you know, it's quite an environmentally aware city in general.
Yeah.
That's been quite badly let down by its transport network.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons for that is primarily because the train station is so hard to access from other areas of the city. So we thought that was one of the most important things to address.
Okay, right. I mean, how do you think that the Bristol's been let down? Be a little bit more sort of specific. How do you think it's been let down as such? I mean, first bus are pretty expensive, I'll certainly grant you, because I'll stop using them. But what else did you think was sort of sorely lacking?
They are quite expensive. I mean, I think in general terms, obviously, we've lost a lot of the regulation of the transport system that we used to have. Mm. We should have a lot of competition going on in Bristol amongst different operators. In fact, we've got First running more than 90% of all the services, and they obviously run the train services as well.
Yeah.
One of the ideas of introducing this model was we'd get lots of competition between the different companies.
Okay.
As it is, we're not getting any competition at all, and that's really one of the things that we're trying to shed a little bit more light on.
I do know there is the only other company that I could name was, I think there's some blue buses operating north of the river whose drivers seem to do sort of ridiculously long 12-hour shifts for nothing. I don't know if they're even still going or not, but I did get picked up quite a few times and they didn't seem to last very long. I stopped seeing them. So tell me how you've got on in the last 12 months. What have you actually been doing in terms of preparation? How much complicated stuff have you had to do to get this going?
Well, we've had to jump through a few hoops, obviously. I mean, most of us are relatively new to the public transport business, so although we have got a few people on board who've got experience in transport. But we've been, you know, making contact with different operators. We've been learning about the regulations which govern bus companies. We've been learning a lot about the existing buses in Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
In December, we ran a trial for 2 days when we drove a nice antique bus around Bristol picking up passengers for free.
Yeah.
And got an amazing response, really. We got lots of coverage in the newspapers and even managed to get enough money in donations to cover the bus for 2 days.
Oh, awesome.
So
a brilliant start.
It's an absolutely brilliant start, and since then we've got about 500 new members. We've got about 700 members, and we've now raised nearly £10,000. So we're pretty optimistic going forward that we can raise more money and start to run more services.
Okay. I noticed when you said you had this meeting last July that local operators were amongst the people in the crowd. How did they, you know, sort of take this news? I can't imagine they were delighted about a free bus service taking their customers away.
Has to be said, we've found a little bit of a kind of the enemy of my enemy is my friend type approach to things, and that actually the smaller operators in the city are really annoyed about the responsibility that First are taking in, with regard to the transport system as well.
How do you mean exactly? Explain it.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of operators in Bristol who are quite keen to expand their role. As it is, First are being given very large handouts by the council. They've got quality service agreements with the council and so on and so forth. And it has to be said that one effect of this is that smaller organisations aren't able to get involved.
Okay, so they're quite keen on you starting.
I think they are quite keen. And to be honest, I think, and we as a group think this will be quite a positive thing for public transport in the city, really, because, you know, it's clear that we do need some kind of reasonably priced service which is linking city centre locations. Yeah. And we think this will actually encourage more people to get onto public transport.
Okay, how are your drivers getting paid? What do they get out of it?
The drivers are properly paid with, you know, with all benefits and entitlements.
Oh, brilliant. Did they come on board quite easily? Think, oh, brilliant, free bus service, that sounds like a...
Yeah, we've had quite a bit of response from bus drivers saying they were interested, actually.
Yeah.
Obviously, it all boils down to the question of funding. And I say that we've raised nearly £10,000.
Yeah.
Sounds like a reasonably good start. But obviously, we're very keen that your listeners and the residents of Bristol in general get on our website and donate or become members, and then hopefully the free bus could be coming to a bus stop near you.
Okay, brilliant. Well, how many services a day are you planning on operating?
Initially, we're running 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. and it's half hourly.
Okay, so that means you've just got the two drivers doing the same loop on rotation. So
that's right. Yeah,
that's right. Okay. When you are when you're launching, are you hoping to get a bit of press attention about this and sort of get your face in the papers and?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Evening Post have already run a couple of stories on us. Venues seem to be very keen on the project.
Are you putting a lot of funding into advertising to try and keep attention going?
Not at all, no. I mean, I think we're pretty confident that this is a kind of novel enough approach that we can attract attention without needing to pay for advertising. We are in discussions with some sort of national media outlets as well, and we're hoping that once we launch, we can get a little bit of coverage there too.
Okay. On a more general note, what do you think about the news story that seems to come out every couple of years? Oh, Bristol's going to get a new tram network. It pops up and then just promptly disappears again for another couple of years.
Mm.
Any particular views on it?
What's interesting about the tram question at the moment is that the bus rapid transit system, which was the bid was being developed as long ago as 2009, I think I'm right in saying, has actually now been agreed by the Department for Transport, which means that they have okayed a significant sum to be spent on infrastructure in Bristol.
Yeah.
So we're now in the slightly bizarre situation that almost everyone in Bristol, including the councillors, including the MPs, and including people from all sorts of different transport campaign groups, would prefer to see a tram on our streets, or an ultra-light train, should I say. And the DfT have okayed that money. It's just a question of, will we now, as a city, kind of sleepwalk towards bus rapid transit, which is actually something that I think none of the residents really want.
Okay. When you say the loop is between Temple Meads and the city centre, what do you think about the state of what Bristol looks like when you come out of Temple Meads station? This often strikes me, but I mean, it looks pretty rubbish, do you think? You've got like a horrible Holiday Inn right in front of you.
Can see that. I think that's probably common amongst a lot of Britain's larger cities. It's not really my field to comment, I'm afraid.
Okay, but maybe your bus service can whisk people away quickly and drop them off somewhere nicer.
That's the plan.
Okay, whereabouts in the city centre do you get dropped off?
It stops at Cabot Circus, Broadmead, and by the War Memorial in the city centre.
Okay, do you have a website?
Absolutely, we've got a website, and it'd be brilliant if your listeners would like to have a look. We've got access to some fascinating documentaries, lots more information about the project, and of course, you can become a member. It's www.freebus.org.uk.
Okay. Have you hooked up with any other people in any other cities who are planning sort of similar things at all?
Not as yet. We have talked to a few people in Bath, which struggles from an equally beleaguered transport system. But no, we're very much kind of trying out the model, and that is our longer term goal, is to develop a model that other cities and other communities can take responsibility for their own transport.
Okay. I noticed, I think the Blue Bus Company used to time their buses about 5 to 10 minutes before the first buses, so they nick all of their customers. So will you be trying a similar approach?
Absolutely. No, absolutely not. We're not interested in competing with existing companies. What we're interested in doing is providing a lot more information about transport and stimulating a lot more discussion, and of course providing a few free bus services.
Okay, and the two buses that you're going to be using for this, are they going to be like the similarly antique, like the one that you had back in December? Or
sadly not. Okay. We will be using much more modern and disabled accessible vehicles, so mothers with prams and such like will be able to board the services easily.
Okay, brilliant. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on, and you've got your launch day on Saturday, June 11th. Is there anywhere particularly people should sort of go if they want to sort of see the launch? Where are you sort of starting off your inaugural bus ride?
I dare say there will be some fun and games at Templemeads. During the trial, we had some various bands playing and lots of volunteers and visits from local politicians.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so when's your first bus leaving? 10 a.m.
10 a.m. on Saturday, June the 11th.
Okay, brilliant. And for the website once again?
Website, one more time, is all of the W's, freebus.org.uk.
Well, Jack, thank you very much for coming in, and I wish you the very best of luck with your free bus service.
Thank you. Hope
you get lots of members. One of our resident poets, Tim Burrows, eagle-eared listeners will know this name well, has a new CD out. It features his poetry set to music that he's composed himself. Here he talks to Michaela Dennis about this new venture.
With me today I have Tim Burrows. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. And we're going to be talking about a new CD you've put together called Soundscapes, which is a kind of hybrid of poetry, sound, music. I mean, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think Soundscapes describes it because it's, you know, I've written the poems and then I thought, well, let's put them in another backing. Let's kind of make them into more of a show, get people to kind of listen to what background I was imagining and they might imagine when they listen to the words, I guess.
So it's a kind of new genre in a way, would you say?
Yes, people have done it. Kerouac did backings, had jazz backings, some of his stuff. But I'm taking my shot on it and I'm doing my own music, so it's not dependent on someone else's interpretation, I guess.
Yeah, so you perform kind of all the accompaniment, I suppose you would call it, to the poems?
Yes, I do. I guess I use some loops, but otherwise it's live and MIDI'd keyboard in or a plug guitar or mandola or something.
So what made you start thinking, I want to add extra to the words?
Well, I love doing poetry and I love doing music, and it's for me to do both is great because it's doing both the things I really love. So I'm putting them together and it means that I can put on a different sort of show, whereas there's lots of people singing songs and there are lots of people doing poetry. If you have something in between, it's kind of can seep into poetry events and also go into music events.
So. Sure. So there's definitely kind of focusing on performance and the extra elements it brings to that.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah.
So how kind of have other people reacted to your new genre?
I think positively. I think sometimes people are thinking, is this music? Am I going to sing? And sometimes people are thinking, is it just going to do a poem? But I did some at the Folk Festival last weekend and I finished with that. And there's one that's now been put on YouTube, Past Phrases. And I think the response is getting people to listen more to the words, but also giving more background. Like, so if something's got a bluesy feel, like something like I've written a piece about Robert Johnson, you can put some of that sort of feel in the background, so you're giving a wider, yeah, you're putting on more of a show. And some people do like to listen to, you know, music as well as have some words.
Would you say it makes it more accessible?
Yeah, I think it makes it more accessible. I think I often listen to, you know, stuff you might listen to late or you're having a bath or something, you know. I think it's also trying to get into the territory that Van Morrison did with Astral Wakes, things like that. Yeah, and I'd like to do more of that because it's new territory. And I think when you've got crossovers between genres, interesting things happen.
Is this a personal thing for you that you want to, because your love of music and your love of poetry, this is a natural step, or is it something that you think would actually benefit the scene a bit more, something slightly more interactive? I don't know, would you say that?
I think it's also responding to, often poetry nights you get too much spoken word, and however much people are performing it up, it's kind of a nice to have an interlude. And up to now, I guess you've had poetry evenings have bolted on a musician, but with something like doing this sort of stuff, you've got a bit of that anyway, you know.
So have other people been interested in kind of what you've put together and the different way that you're moving in?
Yeah, so that, I think so, but as I said, I'm going to hopefully do a launch later in the summer and also maybe try and get visual elements. Maybe Di Taylor might like to do some little bits of clips of film or something, or even have a slideshow, because I'm interested in also making a show sort of different. Bristol's got loads of things happening, but I'm trying to fuse some new things to...
So lots of layers. So you come up with your original spoken word and then...
Yeah, no, and then also they feed back into one another. I find if I've got a piece of music, sometimes I'll improvise and just do something straight out. I wrote a piece in Zenner in Cornwall recently in a kitchen, in a cottage kitchen, and I just improvised a bit of alt-tuned guitar, and then I'd been thinking about the old hermits that lived in caves off the Cornish coast, and why St. Justin's name, St. Justin, St. Cullum, and these people, St. Agnes, and all these places. And it just came together, and I think that's interesting, having to improvise, because improvise is live. It's as live as music or poetry gets. You're really put on the spot. I did the piece about the surreal, and I did the same there. I just improvised. I'd been thinking about it for maybe, you know, some time, but I hadn't actually kind of sat down and written it all down. I said, sort of thought, well, try and see what comes, you know.
Okay.
Which is a sort of hot form of music and poetry. It's a bit like the jazz guys used to do, you know, they'd get to a stage where they didn't want scripts and they just wanted to see what came. But I think you have to have a certain amount of experience before you can do that, and a certain amount to put in, otherwise there's a kind of you know, it's not so good.
Considering we are a radio show, it would be good for these people to actually hear a soundscape. So we've got a couple of examples that I picked out, which I thought particularly interesting. It'd be really great if you could give us some background, some explanation, okay, and kind of talk more about it. So the first one we've got is The Surreal, which you just mentioned a second ago.
Yes, that came off, I read a whole biography on Salvador Dali, and I've always loved surreal art, and it actually led to I put on a little event at the Under the Stars boat, a surreal night, which was great. But that came from, again, it was an exciting area because the imagery and all that thought about seeing the world in a different way and opening up the imagination and going along with stuff like Freud, you know, Freud was looking at the subconscious and things. It's exciting, you know. That's why I did that. The piece on the CD was improvised, and it was one take. It's kind of white hot. I like that. And then I just then midied in some backing straight, and feels like that creative energy is on 100% when you're doing that sort of stuff.
So this is The Surreal by Tim Burrows.
Began with the destruction of life, with the near death of imagination on the battlefields in the trenches of the First World War, with death. Death distended to maybe kill imagination. Death. Death of bones mouldering in the mud. Mud could hold no more bones or metal. Then the spirit began to rise again, but with anger against the futility of the use of the human experience to make nothing but death. But death, death. Take it. Into destruction. Destruction of artists. Expression of the futility of the destructive part of our nature. From that, came the surrealist, something more. Fantasy, something more free, something in the depths of the human soul, the depths of the psyche, the dreams, the visions. It was free, let free, rode free, expressed the best, the fastest, the highest. The voice of those who lived in the clouds. The voice of those who lived in the shadows. The visions of those who saw the powermongers of the world destroying other people in their pursuit of greed and power. That saw the wrenching of the Spanish Civil War. Dali's eyes. So in the poetry, expression of how the weak individual takes on the Nazi death machine. How to get through in those times of trial. Those times when you needed a dream to escape. But the dream took on the nightmare that was life.
So we heard a lot of kind of discordancy and bells, and like you say, it was just improvised and you just found a loop and you went with it. But did you find that with all that discordancy with the bells, it's actually made it quite hard to listen to?
Yeah, I think when you mix it down, and I'm still learning a lot about sound and things, you have to make sure the balance, the music backing or the sound backing, doesn't overpower the words, because what I come back to is the words and the message. And so you have to get the balance right. You
know? I found that quite difficult, especially if you do a one take.
And the use of your voice on the show, I thought was really interesting. It was quite conspiratorial. I don't know whether...
Apocalyptic, yes.
You find, see, for each different piece that you're doing, that you kind of take on an alter ego.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of acting in there, a little bit of acting when I was younger. But I think that, it's an interesting area because you're bringing different things in, and sometimes something demands a voice. I do another piece, The Sisters of Weird, which is about the Sisters of Fate, which is a very old idea. It comes up in Macbeth. But that, really, I'd like to put on an event and get everyone chanting it with, smoke and incense and in a special sort of place, and as a sort of, little ritual, because I think there's a lot of things. As I said, if you're trying to break away from the standard formats, you go and see a film or you go and hear a concert. I kind of like it when things are mixed and matched.
Well, thank you to Tim Burrows and thank you to McKenna Dennis.
A South American country dominated by organised crime, drug running and its North American neighbour, the Colombian government is trying to improve its mafia state image around the world while the killings go on. Colombia is the most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist. And what's more, British taxpayers' money appears to be going to the very government agency supposed to be stopping money laundering, which is colluding in assassinations of journalists. This is the final part of a report by Colombian journalist Claudia Julieta Duque, who was the guest of honour at the delegate meeting of the UK National Union of Journalists in April.
So, this is my message. My message is only that being journalist in Colombia is an adventure, because in a country where you have guerrilla groups, you have paramilitary groups, you have corruption scandals every day, when you have organized crime in power and all powers, and you have all kind of trafficking, not only persons, but drugs, but organs, but everything, it's an adventure to work and to disclose and to research. But it's also a big risk, because nobody wants that we talk about what is really happening there. And when I am in Colombia and people ask me, why don't you go? Last month I received 2 new death threats, and people always are asking, why don't you go the country and do you live and that's it? And I always say, well, if I see the faces of the victims here, if I see the hopes of people that every day came and come after a awful night of violence, and they wake up every morning with the hope to build a different country. Because of them, I am there, and I want to still and stay there. So my requesting for all of you, after giving my special thanks to Jeremy and all of these persons that made possible this membership, is to ask you to involve deeply in what is happening in Colombia, because human rights are universal. Human rights are not of a country, are not exclusively for a part of the world. Universal human rights, and you should be part of this fight, because every that has happened there is a crime against humanity. And as human beings, all of us will be affected with impunity in my country. So I'm sorry for not being so fluent in English today, but my real hope is for changing in Colombia, is to break impunity. It's the only way. While the former president, Álvaro Uribe, be professor in European universities or in American universities, while he's part of the Truth Commission for the flotilla killings in Israel, and while he's a renowned person around the world, we are not hopes that anything changes. The new government kept the national director of the secret police, is the same one than during the government, the last one during the Álvaro Uribe's government. He has not been changed because Juan Manuel Santos, the new president, knows that he is part of what happened. We had documents that prove that the things that the espionage against Ecuador, Venezuela, and Cuba made by the secret police was the results of this were presented to the former Minister of Defense, Juan Manuel Santos, the current president. So he wants to keep the things like that in impunity, not touching the high-profile people. The high-ranked officials involved in this are in total impunity, and we must be continuing fighting against this. And it's a new style in this statement, but it's not a new practice for power in the country. And being a journalist there is a little complicated, but it's also an adventure, and I would like to be alive to continue doing my job there. So thank you so much for your support.
Well, comrades, you've heard, whether as a journalist or a trade unionist, it is the impunity that stalks Colombia that is its real problem. As long as no one is brought to justice for the killings of journalists or trade unionists, those killings will continue. And at that very time, the European Union is in the process of signing a free trade agreement with Colombia. There is still time to be able to stop that, and we're committed, along with all the other UK unions and unions across Europe, to try to do that. But I think any of you out there who are journalists were just given a scoop of a story as well. You might not have realised it, but when Claudia talked about UK government funding of a particular unit of the DAS secret security police who helped to attack journalists, that is information which is becoming clear in court papers which she has secured the release of. I'm talking through this microphone to all those budding student journalists who might want to be putting this out, but of course to all of you as well. It's a vitally important story that we tell, that the UK government is complicit in the murder of trade unionists and journalists in Colombia if it is funding the security services who carry these out. And there must be an urgent investigation and an urgent end to any UK government funding of this regime until impunity is tackled. And finally, two other pieces of paper. One is a leaflet to affiliate to Justice for Colombia, the TUC-backed organisation of which I've been proud to be chair for the last 7 years or so. And please, as individuals and as branches and as local trades councils and others, get involved in that campaign. The other is a piece of paper about the killing of trade unionists in Colombia. And if you want the stark reality, just turn that piece of paper over, and there is the list of names of every trade unionist killed by that regime since 2007. We will not rest until we can turn the piece of paper over and there isn't the name of a single journalist or trade unionist that's been killed in Colombia. Please again thank Claudia, and we pledge our support for her continued struggle.
That was Colombian journalist Claudia Julieta Duque summing up how human rights activists, trade unionists and journalists, the conditions they have to operate under in the South American mafia state of Colombia. And you can read more about that story on the National Union of Journalists Bristol website, which is www.bristolnuj.org.uk.
Malcolm Grieve now reads part 6 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. The music we've used to introduce it is the Pastoral Symphony by Vaughan Williams.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 1, The Old Buccaneer. Chapter 6, The Captain's Papers. We rode hard all the way till we drew up before Dr. Lizzie's door. The house was all dark to the front. Mr. Dance told me to jump down and knock, and Dogger gave me a stirrup to descend by. The door was opened almost at once by the maid. "Is Dr. Lizzie in?" I asked. "No," she said. He had come home in the afternoon, but had gone up to the hall to dine and pass the evening with the squire. "So, there we go, boys," said Mr. Dance. This time, as the distance was short, I did not mount, but ran along with Dogger's stirrup leather to the lodge gates and up the long, leafless, moonlit avenue to where the white line of the hall buildings looked on either hand on great, old gardens. Here Mr. Dance dismounted, and taking me along with him, was admitted at a word into the house. The servant led us down a matted passage and showed us at the end into a great library, all lined with bookcases and busts on the top of them, where the squire and Dr. Livesey sat pipe in hand on either side of a bright fire. I had never seen the squire so near at hand. He was a tall man, over 6 feet high and broad in proportion, and he had a bluff, rough and ready face, all roughened and reddened and lined in his long travels. His eyebrows were very black and moved readily, and this gave him a look of some temper. Not bad, you would say, but quick and high.
"Come in, Mr. Dance," says he,
very stately and condescending.
"Good evening, Dance," said the doctor with a nod.
"And good evening to you, friend Jim. What good wind brings you here?" The supervisor stood up straight and stiff and told his story like a lesson. And you should have seen how the two gentlemen leaned forward and looked at each other and forgot to smoke in their interest and surprise. When they had heard how my mother went back to the inn, Dr. Livesey fairly slapped his thigh, and the squire cried, "Bravo!" and broke his long pipe against the grate. Long before it was done, Mr. Trelawney, that you will remember was the squire's name, had got up from his seat and was striding about the room, and the doctor, as if to hear the better, had taken off his powdered wig and sat there looking very strange indeed with his own close-cropped black poll. At last Mr. Dance finished the story.
"Mr. Dance," said the squire, "you're a very noble fellow, and as for riding down that black, atrocious miscreant, I regard it as an act of virtue, sir, like stamping on a cockroach. This lad Hawkins is a tramp, I perceive. Hawkins, will you ring that bell? Mr. Dance must have some ale."
"And so, Jim," said the doctor, "you have that thing that they were after, have you?" "Here it is, sir," said I, and gave him the oilskin packet. The doctor looked it all over, as if his fingers were itching to open it. But instead of doing that, he put it quietly in the pocket of his coat. "Squire," said he, "when Dance has had his ale, he must, of course, be off on His Majesty's service. But I mean to keep Jim Hawkins here to sleep at my house. And, with your permission, I propose we should have up the cold pie and let him sup."
"As you will, Livesey," said the squire. "Hawkins has earned better than cold pie."
So a big pigeon pie was brought in and put on a side table, and I made a hearty supper, for I was as hungry as a hawk, while Mr. Dance was further complimented and at last dismissed. "And now, squire," said the doctor.
"And now, Livesey," said the squire in the same breath.
"One at a time, one at a time," laughed Dr. Livesey. "You have heard of this Flint, I suppose?"
"Heard of him?" cried the squire. "Heard of him, you say? He was the bloodthirstiest buccaneer that sailed. Blackbeard was a child to Flint. The Spaniards were so prodigiously afraid of him that I tell you, sir, I was sometimes proud he was an Englishman. I've seen his topsails with these eyes off Trinidad, and the cowardly son of a rum puncheon that I sailed with put back, sir, into port of Spain."
"Well, I've heard of him myself in England," said the doctor, "but the point is, had he money?"
"Money?" cried the squire. "Have you heard the story? What were these villains after but money? What did they care for but money? For what would they risk their rascal carcasses but money?"
"That we shall soon know," replied the doctor. "But you are so confoundedly hot-headed and exclamatory that I cannot get a word in. What I want to know is this. Supposing that I have here in my pocket some clue to where Flint buried his treasure, will that treasure amount to much?"
"Amount, sir?" cried the squire. "It will amount to this. If we have the clue you talk about, I fit out a ship in Bristol Dock and take you and Hawkins here along, and I'll have that treasure if I search a year."
"Very well," said the doctor. "Now then, if Jim is agreeable, we'll open the packet." And he laid it before him on the table. The bundle was sewn together, and the doctor had to get out his instrument case and cut the stitches with his medical scissors. It contained two things, a book and a sealed paper.
"First we'll try the book," observed the doctor.
The squire and I were both peering over his shoulder as he opened it, for Dr. Livesey had kindly motioned me to come round from the side table where I'd been eating to enjoy the sport of the search. On the first page there were only some scraps of writing, such as a man with a pen in his hand might make for idleness or practice. One was the same as the tattoo mark, Billy Bones his fancy. Then there was Mr. W. Bones, mate. No more rum. Off Palm Key he got it. And some other snatches, mostly single words and unintelligible. I could not help wondering who it was that got it, and what it was that he got. A knife in his back, as like as not. "Not much instruction there," said Dr. Livesey as he passed on. The next 10 or 12 pages were filled with a curious series of entries. There was a date at the end of the line, and at the other a sum of money, as in common account books. But instead of explanatory writing, only a varying number of crosses between the two. On the 12th of June, 1745, for instance, a sum of £70 had plainly become due to someone, and there was nothing but six crosses to explain the cause. In a few cases, to be sure, the name of a place would be added, such as off Caracas, or a mere entry of latitude and longitude, as 62 degrees, 17 minutes, 20 seconds, 19 degrees, 2 minutes, 40 seconds. The record lasted over nearly 20 years, the amount of the separate entries growing larger as time went on. And at the end, a grand total had been made out after 5 or 6 wrong additions, and these words appended. Bones. His pile. "I can't make head or tail of this," said Dr. Livesey.
"The thing is as clear as noonday," cried the squire. "This is the Black-Hearted Hound's account book. These crosses stand for the names of ships or towns that they sank or plundered. The sums are the scoundrel's share, and where he feared an ambiguity, you see he added something clearer, off Caracas now. You see, here was some unhappy vessel boarded off that coast. God help the poor souls that manned her. Coral, long ago."
"Right," said the doctor. "See what it is to be a traveller." "Right. And the amounts increase, you see, as he rose in rank." There was little else in the volume but a few bearings of places noted in the blank leaves towards the end, and a table for reducing French, English and Spanish monies to a common value.
"Thrifty man," cried the doctor. "He wasn't the one to be cheated." "And now," said the squire, "for the other."
The paper had been sealed in several places with a thimble by way of a seal. The very thimble, perhaps, that I had found in the captain's pocket. The doctor opened the seals with great care, and there fell out the map of an island, with latitude and longitude, soundings, names of hills and bays and inlets, and every particular that would be needed to bring a ship to a safe anchorage upon its shores. It was about 9 miles long and 5 across, and shaped, you might say, like a fat dragon standing up, and had 2 fine landlocked harbours and a hill in the centre marked the Spyglass. There were several additions of a later date, but above all, 3 crosses of red ink, 2 on the north part of the island, 1 in the southwest, and besides this last, in the same red ink, and in a small, neat hand, very different from the captain's tottery characters, these words, "Bulk of treasure here." Over on the back, the same hand had written this further information. "Tall tree, spyglass shoulder bearing a point to the north of north-northeast. Skeleton island east-southeast and by east. 10 feet. The bar silver is in the north cache. You can find it by the trend of the east hummock, 10 fathoms south of the black crag with the face in it. The arms are easy found in the sandhill, north point of north inlet cape. Bearing east and 1/4 north." That was all, but brief as it was, and to me, incomprehensible, it filled the squire and Dr. Livesey with delight.
"Livesey," said the squire, "you will give up this wretched practice at once. Tomorrow I start for Bristol. In 3 weeks' time, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 10 days, we'll have the best ship, sir, and the choicest crew in England. Hawkins shall come as cabin boy. You'll make a famous cabin boy, Hawkins. You, Livesey, are ship's doctor. I am admiral. We'll take Redruth, Joyce and Hunter. We'll have favourable winds, a quick passage, and not the least difficulty in finding the spot. And money to eat, to roll in, to play duck and drake with ever after."
"Trelawney," said the doctor, "I'll go with you. And I'll go bail for it, so will Jim, and be a credit to the undertaking. There's only one man I'm afraid of."
"And who's that?" cried the squire. "Name the dog, sir."
"You," replied the doctor, "for you cannot hold your tongue. We are not the only men who know of this paper. These fellows who attacked the inn tonight, bold, desperate blades for sure, and the rest who stayed aboard that lugger, and more, I dare say, not far off, are one and all, through thick and thin, bound that they'll get that money. We must none of us go alone till we get to sea. Jim and I shall stick together in the meanwhile. You'll take Joyce and Hunter when you ride to Bristol. And from first to last, not one of us must breathe a word of what we've found."
"Livesey," returned the squire, "you are always in the right of it. I'll be as silent as the grave."
Thank you very much to the actor Malcolm Grieve for his reading of Part 6 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And need we say, hang around for Part 7 next week.
It's now my great pleasure to introduce the Bard of Windmill Hill, Trevor Carter. Hello, Trevor.
Hi, Michaela.
What do you have for us today?
I've got stuff that's in the news. I've been thinking about Obama, a speech at Westminster, and the capture of Mladic. So I did write something about Obama's inauguration, which is in my new book. And I was kind of mindful of that. This was going back over 2 years, and this is what I wrote for the inauguration. A very memorable occasion, I'm sure, because I said to my wife at the time, this is history, we'll remember this. Did you watch it yourself?
I did, yeah. We all had the afternoon off work and watched it. It was amazing.
Yeah, incredible event. He stood there in the winter chill to offer us his hope. A worried world beheld his will. He tells us we can cope. The tone is somber, words well judged. He knows how to affect, as he hints his predecessor fudged the issue of respect. He notes his nation is yet young and says it must grow up. A humbler message should be sung. The world drinks from one cup. The accolades come thick and fast. We sense an awesome power. Is this true leadership at last, at this momentous hour? So that was 2 years ago, and of course he's had some problems, and a lot of people have been kind of a bit disillusioned, a bit unimpressed, particularly over the Libya issue. But I think his stock's been rising again recently, you know, of course, with the Obama gets Osama chant, you know, so and since then he's been on the up and performed very well at the Palace of Westminster. I did hear some of the speech, and he made some kind of half joke about the last three people to have spoken in Westminster Hall, being the Queen, the Pope, and Nelson Mandela, and how he was supposed to be following them. It was quite pithy the way he managed it. So there's a little commentary on that. He hooks us with a witticism that almost was a joke, an antidote to cynicism, a statesman who's a bloke. Some talk of his sense of poetry and how his words can open doors, his resonance, his oratory, and knowing when to pause. And though spaces are important, they give us time to think. And as he enthralls his audience, we may sense in him a link to great orators of the past whose styles could so enrich. And we behold the bloke and statesman who knows exactly how to pitch. And then, of course, we had the capture of Mladic. Very dramatic, 16 years on the run. And now, finally, he's behind bars. I think this was just the following day. The capture of Mladic. A slug can hide, but cannot run. A thug can hide behind a gun, make random death a form of fun, and become a national hero. An obscene beast of Balkan wars is lurking behind prison doors, awaiting sentence for a cause his twisted soul believed in. This lord of modern genocide has many Serbians on his side. It seems that many take a pride in the crimes he masterminded, while others are relieved he's caught. They hope forgiveness can be bought for the massacres that Mladic wrought. But atonement's not that easy.
Thank you very much, Trevor.
Yes.
Now the regular What's On Guide, read by a tastefully dressed this week, Jeff Sparks. No Cradle of Filth t-shirts.
Thank you. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 10th of June, Keith James performs the songs of Leonard Cohen at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Also on Friday 10th of June, the ex-Marillion singer Fish will be performing with support from Jibo at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:45 p.m. and entry is £17.50 in advance and £20 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Ladysmith Black Mambazo. This group formed in Ladysmith, South Africa in 1960, and to date they have released over 50 albums. This is from their latest album, Songs from a Zulu Farm, and it's a track titled Old MacDonald Zulu Style.
Old MacDonald, why ne plas? Hiya, hiya, oh. Kulelo plasi, why ne ngom?
Oh, a cow.
With a mumu ye, and a mumu ye. Naimu, naimu, yongi ndawi mumu. Babu MacDonald, why ne plas? Hiya, hiya, oh. Babu MacDonald, why ne plas? Hiya, hiya, oh. Lelo plazi wine mbuz.
Oh, good.
With the meme ye and the meme ye. Naime, naime, yogi tawi meme. Babu MacDonald wine plaz. Ia, ia, oh. Babu MacDonald wine plaz. Ia, ia, oh. Kulelo plazi wine nkuku. Ia,
it's a chicken.
With a pack pack there and a pack pack there. Now you pack, yogi, now we pack pack. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Kulelo plazi, why ne ulub? Ia, ia, oh. With a pack pack there and a pack pack there. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Kulelo plasi, why ne zincha? Ia, ia, oh. With a woof woof here and a woof woof there. Nai woof, yogi dawi woof woof. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Kulelo plasi, why ne chap?
Oh,
ia, ia, oh. With a papa here and a papa there. Naipa, naipa, yogi dawi papa. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh. Kulelo plasi, why ne tata?
Oh, a duck.
With a quack quack here and a quack quack there. Nay quack, yogi dawi quack quack. Babu MacDonald, why ne plus? Ia, ia, oh.
For all of us in Ladysmith Black Mambazo, we want to thank you for visiting our farm in South Africa. Siyabonga. Please visit again. Bye-bye.
That was a Ladysmith Black Mambazo with Old MacDonald Zulu Style from the album Songs from a Zulu Farm. For more information, you can check out www.mambazo.com. On Saturday, 11th of June, Troy Ellis and the Hail Jamaica Band will be performing with support from Peachy Farmer at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is £3.50 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 12th of June, Stone Cold Hustle will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Cheers, Jeff. Well, it's a good thing Ladysmith Black Mambazo came from Ladysmith. Imagine what it would be like if they came from Clanquerpil, Gwynguil, Gogolith, Wernja, Balantisilio, Gogolgoch.
And that concludes this week's edition of Dialect. Many thanks to our guest Jack Phillips from Bristol Free Bus.
The features this week were from Michaela Dennis, who talked Tim Burrows about his latest venture, a poetry and music CD. Tony Gosling gave us the final part of his Claudia Julieta 2K about the mafia government in Colombia.
Trevor Carter read us a poem, and Jeff Sparks gave us his What's On Guide. This show was produced this week by Alex Milne, and the studio engineer was Mike Noyce.
I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
Have a great week and goodbye.
that?
The chemist of Amperdan.
What's he looking for?
Absolutely nothing.
Thank you.
mushroom.